Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hello, it's Martin here, Electronically Yours, as I am every week. Today's guest is one of the originators of house music, and not to be sneezed at, such a thing. I'm a big fan of early Chicago house and Detroit techno, and Derek Carter, or is this he, kindly agreed to be interviewed today. I love his style of Chicago house. It's more kind of soulful and organic and hardcore beats, actually, as well. And, you know, really funky. And I think, as I mentioned in the actual interview, I think I prefer the American version of house music to the European version generally, because I'm a soul boy. And what a delightful chap he is. I'd never met him before. I didn't know what to expect, really, but I really like his work, and he's such an engaging character. So here he is, Mr. House, Derek Carter. Tell us about growing up. I mean, you were born in Oakland, is that right? And then you moved to Chicago, is that right?
I was born in Compton.
Compton, sorry, not Oakland.
Yeah. But I mean, it's this sort of that thing. I was born in, like, you know, in 69. So that's still in the period where my mom was 20 at the time, and she had older sisters. So, you know, when you're pregnant and you're young, you go stay with, like, older female elders. You go live with your older sisters or stay with your mother or something. So my mom had two sisters that lived in California, and so she went... was out there with them. One of my mom's sisters, one of my aunts, was a nurse at a hospital, and that's the hospital I was born in. So it was just a matter of just, like, happenstance that I was born there. We didn't really live there necessarily. We were staying there.
Right.
And then, yeah, then we left.
So you grew up in Chicago, is that right?
Yeah. Grew up in Chicago, and then we moved out to the suburbs when I was like six, and then I moved back when I was like 18.
Right.
And I just can't handle it.
Oh, right. You needed to be part of where the action was, no doubt.
Yeah.
So tell us about the, because I've never been lucky enough to interview any of the kind of originators of this scene. You're the first one. And tell us about, set the scene for us at that period of time. So I suppose we're talking mid-80s, aren't we? And
yeah.
Tell us about who was happening at that point and what your role in all that was.
Well, I tell you, I was, like, some of this may, you know, predate me a bit, but I'd always been buying records and always going to the record stores, and then having, like, you know, DJing at teen dances, and the local kind of recreation center would have what they call, like, Coke dances, where they just serve Cokes.
Oh, thank God.
They were getting them in early. No. It was like, you know, have Coke dances and things like that. So, it was just like a big radio driven thing. Not all the radio stations, the black radio stations had mixes, WBMX, then later WGCI, and then all the college stations as well.
Yeah.
Would do mixes. So you have a mix, you have like a morning mix, you have a hot lunch mix, you have an after work mix every day. And then you have on the weekends, Friday and Saturday, mixes that were played along the same times as the clubs were open. So in Chicago, the clubs are open. There's 2 o'clock clubs and 4 o'clock clubs, which become 3 o'clock clubs and 5 o'clock clubs on Saturday. You get an extra hour on the weekend. So on Friday, they play mixes from like 10 p.m. until 4 a.m. And just like a rotating cast of, you know, the station's regular DJs. And on Saturday, they play till 5. Often the extra hour on Saturday would be like a guest mix from someone.
Yeah.
And so like, that's why I always started picking up all the music. You know, we had Disco DAI at the time as well, just before the BMX thing. And that's the, I guess, the catalyst for what ended up being Disco Demolition at Comiskey Park, where the rock jock just had enough of disco and DAI and this sort of thing and tried to kill disco.
All that bullshit, yeah.
This thing. Chicago's turbulent. But so I on my first day of orientation for college, I met some people standing in line. I can be gregarious. I can like hang out and whatever, chat with people. I met these two people, George and Connie, and I was 17 at the time. So full of bravado. I was going to school on a scholarship. I was like, you know, whatever, I'm supposed to be here. But I was also lazy. So I didn't want to go to school, but my parents were making me. I met these two and they became sort of my friends. And during the course of this, within a couple of months, I was like, I need a job. And George is like, oh, you want to work at Imports? And Imports, et cetera, was the kind of the spot. It was the record store. You know, it was the place. It's the place that like actually gave house music its name. Like house music, it was named after the warehouse, but the reason it was called house music was because they had a bin of records at this record store that said house music on it. And that was alluding to stuff Frankie would play at the warehouse. So it was a marketing kind of gimmick for them to sell more product. But that's how house music got its name.
Yeah, we're talking about Frankie Knuckles, yeah?
Yeah. So Frankie was like a regular shopper and customer there. Chip E, who did like Time to Jack and Like This and a few other things, was working there as well. But by the time I got there, they'd all left. So this is like 1987. And then I just worked there and had an ear and just would do lots of odd parties, loft parties more so, because at the time I wasn't 21, I was 17. Wow. And I looked older, but you know, at a certain point, particularly on the north side of Chicago, they had this thing where they wanted Black people to have like more than one form of ID. Like you have to have like three forms of ID to get into a club. Like who the fuck carries three forms? I'm 53 now and I don't have three forms of ID. You know, this like, what the hell? So I just would do, we do like a lot of loft parties. We used to do these parties called the substance parties. And we would like get in and like, I ended up partnering with my guy, Mark Farina. Had been going to school in Arizona, like ASU or something like this, and either got kicked out or decided to leave and decided to go to Columbia, which is a college, not Columbia University, but like around the corner from where the record store was. So he started coming in and just like we became friends. And then we just started doing a lot of events and kicking it off and like running around town being cool dudes at, you know, 18, 19. We had a permanent slot on the Northwestern University radio station called Street Beat. We were the resident DJs. And then like somehow again via this George Andros connection, I managed to snag a album deal with Kevin Saunderson, KMS.
Yeah.
To do this cymbals and instruments thing that we ended up doing, which was like an ambient forerunner, whatever. And you know, it's just a lot of like, I guess, right place, right time. Right amount of gumption too, because I don't like no, I like to say no to people, but I don't like to take no from people. So I'll rephrase it, reframe it, reconstitute it, recontextualize it. So it sounds better. How about if I put it like this? How about if I say it like this? And we ended up just like getting gigs, residencies at Shelter, which was a like the club in Chicago at the time. Kaboom, which we parlayed into a Italian residency in Bisceglia, Bari, Italy, for a couple of summers. Just
it's like Italo disco then.
Well, it was just Italian discos. Yeah. This was a bit later. This is probably like 91, 92.
Right.
And like it was crazy though. During this whole time, this like imports, et cetera time, which I got fired from twice. It was like the golden age. Because all these great records were coming out. The UK had just discovered kind of house music in a way. And everything was a lot of fun. Here's another little tidbit. While I was working at Imports, a couple of weirdos, like really weird, like weirdos came into the store. And they were like, yo, we're looking for this record called Superman by Sully B. And I'm like, all right, cool. We got a copy. You know, we did disco house, all kinds of things. We had a section called Asian New Wave, which is like kind of trancy things, whatever. So they came looking for this record and I got them this record. And I'm like, you know, anything else you're looking for? And they're like, oh, what do you have? What kind of new sounds do you have? I'm like, we have these. So I hooked them up with like a bunch of acid records that were just coming out of the city at the time, kind of proto house, proto techno things, whatever. Turned out that those weirdos were Genesis Peorage, Aula, and Richard, who I believe was Mr. Monday at the time or something like this. And they took these records home and then made like Jack the Tab and all these sorts of things that ended up being like acid house, you know, back then. So I kind of ended up helping to kick off acid house as well in the UK. Which I'm kind of
isn't
you
it
know,
interesting how the kind of explosion of people loving house music kind of quickly flowered into lots of different subgenres. I mean, and also the fact that it was very much a kind of virtuous circle of people recommending records. Like I've heard this story a lot about people starting off in record stores. I interviewed James Lavelle from Mo Wax, and a similar kind of thing, but from the English side, right, with DJ Shadow and all that stuff. And it's like a kind of fraternity, brotherhood, you know, sisterhood, whatever.
It's a breeding ground.
Yes.
You know,
I think that's really an important point in the whole proliferation and the reason why house is still popular today. You know,
I'm down with all that. I wish there were still these kinds of temples or meeting houses, you know, that people could go to and shoot the shit on a Saturday afternoon. You know, it's basically what it was. You know, people, it's like all kinds of people who were interested in music, people who liked music, and they would just come in and like really, really be hungry for music. And that just walking through the door was powerful because they were already hungry. They're asking to be fed. It's like a lot of people just wanting something that you may or may not have, but you could recommend put them onto something new, or you know, you got a couple limited things that you have behind the counter and it makes them feel good and they run off, and because it's limited they want to play it five times as much, or you tell them it's limited, they want to play it five times as much as any other record. And then that's how you know records break.
And white labels and all that stuff.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. Is there, what's left of that in Chicago now then?
Well, there's Gramophone, which is taken over kind of the place that imports had held for a while, occupied. I also have stories about that.
Yeah, tell us.
After they fired me from imports for the second time, I called Andy, who was the manager at Gramophone, and was like, yo, man, I need a job. They just fired me. And
why did they fire you?
More or less insubordination.
Oh, yeah.
I was a cocky 20-year-old at that time.
Right, right.
I like was probably too big for my britches.
Oh, you know,
I can see that now. But then what do you do when you're 20? You have all the bravado in the world. You That's just it. Walk around cock of the walk. You just can't, nobody can tell you shit. So I got fired, and then they rehired me, and then they fired me again. And the second time was when I called Andy. I'm like, yo, I need a job. So he got me a job that day at Gramophone. And I kind of made it my mission to put imports out of business.
I
was salty because I'm like, yo, I'm doing great things here. And they're like, well, we just don't want to do that. Like, all right, Ken, who was the manager. All right, Ken. So I went to Gramophone, and they were like a rock and roll kind of folksy store with like a small bin of dance music. They also had, some of the like Jesus Jonesy kind of thing, like the Stone Roses kind of things that were coming out of the UK at the time. So they were focused more on that. It was like a small bin of, select imports and various things. And I somehow conned them into giving me some spaces on the wall. The walls were always like, where you put the new hot stuff, just like all the walls and in the bins. So I got a couple spaces on the wall, and then my wall stuff started doing really well. And they gave me some more spaces, and then they gave me some more spaces. And then after a while, I had like a whole wall to myself.
Curated by Derek Carter, right?
Exactly. And then when they decided to expand, it was a store next door. It wasn't a store next door. It was a store around the corner. And there's like Gramophone, and a Mexican restaurant. And then on this side was another store. So they broke out the wall here and there, and Gramophone turned into this L with the Mexican restaurant still sort of in the corner spot. But then that side bit became like the more urban things, more up-to-date things. And I got a whole giant section. I just ran that section. I was a Billboard reporter for a while. I was doing, cool things at like 20, 21 years old, And so that's how a lot of that, got going. But then, Gramophone is still there. They moved to a new place because the old building's manager was a little eccentric. And they're still kicking. A couple other places, I'm trying to think. There's like a 606 place that does decent stuff. It's not the old days. We had Loop Records, Rose Records. There was JR's, Coconuts, even the chain stores, got in on it back then. They would like sell, dance music and all that. And now it's, just like two or three independents with like, more closing all the time. There used to be this one really great used record store called Dave's, and Dave had enough, I guess, and decided to no longer be in the record store.
That's so sad, isn't it? I think all that stuff. When did you first come to London then?
First time I came to London was in 1992.
Right. And did you have any...
No, I lie. It was in 1991, November of 1991.
Right. And was that because you had meetings in London or you just came over for a scope?
No. So what had happened was I had somehow made a connection with this guy, Lyndon. Lyndon C. Stew parties at Villa Stefano. In in London at some place, and like with the Bobby and Steve from Kiss, when Kiss was still a pirate station, and somebody was trying to get in touch to have Kashmir come play. I was working, I had left Gramophone. I'd been fired from Gramophone by that point. Stories. And I was working for Casual Records.
Right.
And so working for Kashmir, and Cash was like at my house and we were chatting, and this guy wanted to get Kashmir over because Kashmir had some hot records, Percolator and Brighter Days and some other things that, you know, were doing numbers over there. And so we were trying to get Cash, because Cash wasn't a DJ, trying to get Cash up to like how, like DJing and stuff. And at some point I was like, man, fuck him, bring me over.
Yeah.
Wow. He's like, well, you know, I don't know about you. I'm like, look, I got some records. David Holmes had just put out an EP of mine on Exploding Plastic Inevitable. And he's like, well, let me see who can vouch for you. So he had Terry Hunter, who's another like great Chicago guy, vouch for me. And then I went over with my buddy Josh Werner, who was also a resident of Shelter, but who worked at Gramophone as well. And just like, we wanted to go to London. We didn't realize anything. We just go to London.
Right.
Have a place to stay. Yeah. We had very little money. We ended up sleeping on the floor of some magazines, like offices for a couple of days. And then they were like, you can't stay here, man. You got to go. But, you know, whatever. We figured it out and ended up playing Soundshaft, which was around the back of Heaven. At that time. And I played Villa Stefano and like a couple other things. They had me on Kiss FM. At the time, I remember going, and Inner City was doing great with like Good Life. And I'd known, you know, I'd been signed to KMS. So I was like, hey, where are y'all staying? They were touring and I was trying to get in with them. They said no.
Did you ever meet a very, very good friend of mine? He's passed away now, unfortunately, called Mick Clark. He used to work for, he signed Inner City in the UK.
I know the name. I kind of feel like I had met him.
He must have met you because you are right up his street. You know, he signed Inner City. He signed loads of, he was a kind of curator and creator of this, of that scene in the UK. On 10 records. I met him with
Neil Rushton once. Way back then, Neil Rushton was running his 10 records.
10 records, that's it. Nick Hart was on 10 records.
Right, okay.
So, yeah. Yeah, anyway, just thought to mention it in case you met him.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to go, just rewind a little bit. Who were your major musical influences when you first started DJing? I mean, who were your favorite artists? Were they soul artists?
No. Always Prince.
Yeah.
Always. I guess I didn't really have artist influences. I still don't really care for like artists, because most artists are just, you know, shells that somebody else comes in, fills up, producers, et cetera, et cetera. So I like producers and I like people with good musical taste. So, you know, I had my favorite other DJs who would pick things, like Farley was a favorite because he always had like interesting things that, you know, being a little bit older, I didn't know about and would play things on the radio. Steve Hurley. He was one of the like almost semi-permanent guests on the radio show. Mike Hitman Wilson, who was doing like Another Sleepless Night and working with Sean Christopher back then. Who else? Like, I liked a lot of Italo disco stuff, but that's more of like a genre than, you know, any particular artist or producer is definitely a sound. But like, yeah, and Ralphie Rosario, like I've known Ralphie since I was in, I believe I was like my freshman year in high school. He used to work at a record store and I rode my bike there and was like, oh, you're the guy from the radio. How you doing? And I was like maybe 14. And so I've known Ralphie for, you know, almost 40 years because of that. Still cool. He plays my the night that I do at Smart Bar Queen. He's one of our go-to guests, doing lots of things. Like, just lots of people who were active, but maybe not, like, the nameplate.
Yeah, you know? Of course. Yeah, I understand it. So it's more of a kind of underground thing, really.
Yeah. Like, various people sharing influences and just, like, secret finds. Like, what is that? You know, also, always Frankie and Ron. I used to see Ronnie fairly regularly at the record store. He'd come in and like look for things. After a while, he would like, you know, sell some records and pick up some records and that thing, because we also bought collections. Both of the stores bought collections from people so they could have them to have more interesting things in store. I'd met Ronnie at a meeting I'd had at Trax Records with Larry Sherman. I'd made some, my mom was very kind to me as a kid. She was trying to keep me out of trouble. So she would, you know, occasionally give me like some money. And I had a friend of a friend who was running a studio at the time. And for $100, I could make a record, which was fine. So instead of Air Jordans, I made beats. And great. I had made the, like, three or four songs, and I'm like, oh, these are good songs. I'm going to take them and see if I can get a deal with them. Took them down to meet up with Larry Sherman at Trax. My mom drove me to Bridgeport, which at that time was not very Black-friendly. Got in there, and I met Ron in the office, in the meeting, and he just sat there and, like, brushed his hair for hour. He just sat there and like listening. Like, I guess he was maybe Larry's or some sort. But Ronnie just brushed his hair for like a half an hour. And I was like, all right, cool. In the end, they turned me down, whatever. And I was like, fine. I'll show you.
Yeah, but that's it. That's exactly in it. I believe at various points in my career that's been an engine that's driven me onto other things.
Right. I think so. I mean, people use that kind of rejection, that feeling of maybe inadequacy, or at least not being understood or seen to, if I want to be seen, then, you know, I'll figure out a way. I'll figure out something.
Absolutely. So, right, we're going back to the UK now. So what influences did you pick up from the European and UK scenes, do you think, in your oeuvre? That's a posh word, isn't it?
There you go. You are a professor, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm a motherfucking professor.
Yeah. I know. I see your resume. a lot of things. after a while, I, you know, had some more interesting connections. I ended up meeting Luke Solomon, who I ended up doing Classic Records with and a few things at a club in Chicago. And they're like, oh, we want to meet my friend Luke, blah, blah, blah. And I always heard that British people could drink. Chicago motherfuckers can drink.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, all right, bet. So we ended up doing like 8 or 9 shots. And Luke passed out in the bathroom at the club. I was like, this what you send me? This is your best warrior? Motherfucker, this what you
send the next warrior in.
You know, really. But that cemented our friendship. That, like, we were like, all right, cool. So I ended up moving to London and living as there as Luke and his now wife's boarder in the spare room. On and off for like a few years, you know, 4 or 5 years. And this became a heavy, heavy foundation for me. I mean, that's when we started Classic, when I was living in Barnett, East Barnett.
Barnett, okay.
East Barnett Village, mate. And just being around this, like, music was cool, you know. We didn't have that in Chicago. You got it. You had a job. You had like family or something, and then you would go out and like have a DJ session or something on the weekends. Or yeah. You would. It was like definitely a pastime and not a actual lifestyle.
Right.
Whereas when I got to London, it was a lifestyle. I met, you know, soul boys and like house people, and then like new romantics.
Oh yeah,
kinds of like interesting people who like lived a scene, and I appreciated that. You know, the only place I saw that again was in Japan, where, you know, they live a scene. But that was really formative for me, in the sense that I could just do music, really?
Yeah.
I don't have to get a regular job. I can just do music. Okay. You know, my dad worked for 3M for like 35 years. My mom was a teacher for like 40 years. So I only knew, you know, these kinds of blue collar working people who worked day in and day out.
Yeah,
you know, you're 2 weeks a year or whatever. And,
yeah.
You know, that's it.
Same in Sheffield, yeah.
You know, so being there and seeing that, I was like, yo, I'm just going to do music. Like, it was freeing. And then meeting people who were also doing it, like, just straight up hustling. You know, yeah. I'm going to start a label, and then now this label is huge. You know, like, what the hell, how'd that happen? Well, we had a good record. You know, I like to quote this line I remember reading in The Face somewhere or something like that, about how at the time you could be famous in England for having a great haircut.
No.
Like, it was just like, did you see his hair? And then you become a star because you got this hair.
It's a small, like, it's a small compact country, unlike America, of course, which is way too big. You know, it's like ideas spread fast in the UK, right? Because everybody's close to each other. So
up and down the motorway.
I can see that thing. I mean, I remember I interviewed Nile Rodgers on the podcast, and he was talking about when he the origins of Chic. What did it for him? The epiphanal moment for him was going to see Roxy Music in New York and seeing all the kind of English expats and the American kids copying them, all dressing up in you know, glamorous outfits in the audience. And he said he'd never seen that before. And he said, right, I'm gonna do Sheep like that. We're gonna be the sharpest band.
Yeah. That's awesome. Oh, that's excellent. I mean, I think that's a kind of thing that led to possibly, like, you know, Club Kids in New York.
Yeah.
And this whole sort of thing where you know, like, we would, there was a level of looking sharp where you dressed to go out, but it wasn't, you know, like, extravagance.
It was streetwear, like, right?
It was streetwear, but it was like, you know, it may have been like, you know, like, we call them hard bottoms. It was like hard bottom shoes and a nice sweater.
Things
you would wear to maybe a christening. And not to the discotheque. But I like that the English, like, and I would go up, people just wear makeup and then, like, some crazy, you know, Adam Ant 3.
Yeah.
Just, like, you know, just something wild and weird and just bouncing around and having the time of their life. And that had an impact on me as well. You know,
yeah, there used to be a nightclub in my hometown, Sheffield, called Gatecrasher, which used to win Club of the Year.
Yeah, I played it.
I mean, they like dressing up there. You know, that's a big deal as well. And that was a cool club.
Yeah, I think I played Gatecrasher, and somehow I'd gotten really, really drunk at dinner, and they couldn't get me up, and they finally got me up and rolled me into the club. And I was like, I was playing with the Chemical Brothers.
Right.
And, I was like, all right, I'm going to just need 5 minutes. So whatever. I got in the booth. I'm like, all right, here we go. So I took my shoes off and proceeded to play. And it was like one of the best sets that they said that anybody ever played. It's like, Cobb, you were dead an hour ago, and now you're doing this. I'm like,
the power of the Sheffield audience, right?
Yeah, it was great. I was like, all right, cool. This is before they went like more trancy and progressive. But it was a lovely time. I used to have fun, a lot of fun in Sheffield. It's like Chris Needs.
I remember that. Yeah.
Him up there. And who else? It was like the 0121 crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Something.
Did you play Ibiza?
Yes.
And which clubs did you play there?
Always Space. I had a residency at Space on the Terrace. And then I did one Manumission. I did a couple of, I had a Pasha residency for a while.
We are not worthy.
just bouncing around. I did all the spots at some point, I believe.
Right, yeah. It's cool.
You know, whatever they were before they were, before I played them then, like this is the third iteration of this, but it used to be, I used to, you know, get out there. But I had a really odd view of that place at that time, just like debauchery, which,
oh yeah,
I got it. I dig it, but it was way more holiday debauchery than seemingly musical. Like, people liked the music because they were fucked up. They were high as hell because they were on mushrooms and whatever. So the music was an integral part, but it wasn't like they necessarily came for the music. Came out of that.
They came for the drugs and the drink, basically.
And the holiday. I got 2 weeks to be. Hopefully, I make it home. You know, and that sort of thing. And I'm like, I just want the music. I'll do the drugs sometimes. I'll do some of your drugs, thank you. But I was there always for the music, because that's my thing. I'm not a drug dealer. I'm a music dealer.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I wanted to, like, you know, my feature and focus was the music. So, I mean, I still kind of have some, I won't say reservations, but going there, especially now, it's changed a lot. You know, now it's like,
I think it's cleaned up a bit, hasn't it? Okay.
Depends on what time it is. Depends on the season. If it's, you know, mid August, things can happen.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. So tell me, how do you think your music's evolved over the years? How do you think your taste has evolved?
It has evolved. I know it has. Part of it's evolved because in producing then, I didn't have any equipment. I had an R8. I had an Emax 2, a DX100, and like a Proteus.
Right.
And so I just did everything I could with that. Oh, I also had an FZ1 that my roommate had, and like this thing called a Sansui 6-track. I also had a 303, but I had a 303 because my mom drove me up to Evanston, which is like way far north, to get one. I'd found someone was selling one that came into the record store, and I had my mom drive me to get it. I still have it. But so I had this very sort of limited palette.
Right.
So it was just all a matter of like, this thing that I've still referenced, you know, not necessarily what the equipment can do, but what you can do with the equipment.
Yeah, of course.
And so at that point, I was like wringing every fucking ounce of anything I could out of this equipment. You know, I end up getting an 808 that I bought from Dominic Capello, who's like one of the residents at Sub Club. And I had a 909 that I ended up getting that I bought from some dude that came into the record store and was selling it. Because that was the other thing about the record store. It was the record store, but it was also like a flea market, like swap meet, like a boot sale. People in with like a drum machine. It's like, yeah, man, y'all want to buy a drum machine? Yeah,
Did you ever get a Lindrum?
No. I had one here for a while that belonged to my buddy JT.
That's my favorite, definitely. Absolutely.
I didn't have Lindrum money. I was just happenstance. I had no underwriters. But especially in that time, though, it was just a matter of trying to work with what I had. And then now, as like, whatever, I made a little bit of extra money and like have a better idea of what I want and need, I have better tools, you know. I can experiment more and try this with this. What happens if I do this with this and that? So it's still, I guess, the same kind of ethos of working, but the palette, I have better paints.
Well, it's unlimited now, isn't it? More or less. I mean, good Lord. I mean, even if somebody said to me, you can only use what's inside the, you know, the Macintosh and all the virtual sense and everything, you could still never run out of.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I actually had, I was like a tube dude for a very long time for no good reason. I just thought they were cool. So I had like racks and racks of old tube gear, RCA BB6A, Altex, just gate stay levels, all this old crazy tube stuff, Uries, Teltronics. Yeah. And then I realized, like, I'm doing electronic music. I don't need it. The reason I'd had it, though, is because before plugins and things had really been able, or rather, computers were able to manage all of the plugins properly.
Yeah.
You know, computers where you could run like two instances, maybe three instances, and things would start to kind of glitch. So, I just got a rack. Now that computers have advanced to the point where I can run 20 instances, one on each track and then some, you know, I was like, well, I really don't need any of that. I really don't need any of that.
Yeah.
And I've streamlined my studio down quite a bit, even though I didn't. I just got rid of like my doubles and things I don't need, because like whatever in the box is powerful enough to manage a lot of that. There's a lot that in the box won't give you, but you know, for that I have the rest of this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You've got enough keyboards, man. I think
you haven't seen the other side.
They can't see this shit because it's only in audio, but it is like hundreds of I love your, first of all, I like the kind of roughness of your beats. I think you've really nailed that shit. I don't know what you do to them. A lot of compression and stuff and nothing. No. Okay.
Trade secret.
But I love the genuine kind of funkiness and the roughness of it. It's not too clean, in other words. But I also love your sense of, you know, melody and the musicality of what you do. It's really quite special. And, you know, that's not to be taken for granted because there's a million house DJs out there, as we all know. And everybody can beat match now and everybody can do this shit. And it's about taste, right? And you've got taste.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to let everybody know that they need to go and find your shit on the internet. And I was just watching, I've just watched an hour's worth of you DJing, where was it, in Sao Paulo?
The
Valentine, that's funny, man.
The hellscape. Ah!
It was funny though, because there's all these dudes and women coming in doing all fucking
doing their everything. Yeah. And I'm just like looking at them like, yo.
Oh no, but
please save me.
I love the French Kiss Superstition mashup. That was cool.
There you go. Yeah. That's the thing, like on the radio here, they used to always play like acapellas over other beat tracks or something like that. You know, it wasn't like I feel like I try to advance it a bit, but that was like my thing. Like you get a, like if a record had an acapella, that was like, ooh, that's like
a
it's like a bonus beat or something. You could like, I could do whatever with this.
Yeah.
So that whenever I would find or get or trade or somehow come into acapellas, I mean, that's my jam. You know, I like, because I still say, you know, the voice is the first instrument.
Yeah.
And people are like, why you play a lot of vocals? I'm like, the voice is the
original. Come on, man. Yeah.
Like, what a, like, you just want to da-da-da-da all night. Like, you don't want to hear anybody's point of view. You don't want to learn anything. You don't want to feel a feeling other than a key change or, you know, the way an arpeggiator, like, flippity flop the floops, like, whatever. Like, voices are great if you have the right voices.
Exactly.
So I always was into just, like, great voices. And I think that's going back to an earlier point, like that's a big musical influence on me, is people that could sing. Like,
yes.
I love somebody who can sing. I like people who can sing, but if you can sing, like that was, I still get goosebumps occasionally when I hear someone that, like, you know, drops it and then like hits a note an octave higher and then goes higher, and I breath control and all the muscle movements and the things that takes. Like, people don't understand the mechanics of it, but it's amazing. And I find that to be really, 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 really inspiring, because I'm like, I preach to me, tell me all about
it. Yeah, exactly.
It broke your heart, baby. Make me feel it. Show me that anger. Show me that resolve. Give me everything. Put a shit out on the front door.
Human connection. Human connection. That's what it's about.
Really?
And I am telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's like,
that was like a regular radio song when I was growing up. Like, I hated it because it was like,
yeah,
slow.
Yeah.
Except for the end when she goes, wait a minute. Wait a minute. And then, like, you know, now I just think it's just brilliance.
Absolutely.
And was like a class fave of mine when I was growing up. I just loved that. My uncle turned me on to Minnie Riperton.
Riperton. My God, those albums that she did was
He was a Rotary Connection fan. He was like, you know, let me listen to records. He had a hi-fi with like a old Pickering cartridge that had like a little brush on the front.
Remember hi-fis? Oh my God.
I had to be very careful with, like, you know, like, oh, mess it up. That needle cost $80 in like 1975, which is like, you know, $5,000 now, whatever.
Yeah,
but he was a serious audiophile and would just, like, you know, make sure, blah, blah. But he trusted me, and I could just listen to things and record them. And I'd come back from my uncle's place with, like, tapes that I just would listen to and enjoy. And then he's like, don't tape over it. I'm letting you make this tape. You got to keep it. And so I had a bunch of them, like a bunch of tapes, until my little brother found them and then taped over them.
Oh, no, 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 no.
The one thing that I'm still angry about is I had a Jamie Principal. I traded someone Jamie Principal Live at the Music Box cassette, and he taped over that. I thought I was going to kill him. Like, I literally... I literally wanted to strangle him. Like, I love him a lot. But in that moment, you erased. It was something I knew I'd never see again, even at that point, and I still never have
People look at it on YouTube, though. They might be on YouTube. Everything turns up eventually. You know?
Whoever got me that copy, I think it was my friend Corey at the time. Like, please put it up somewhere because my brother taped over it in, like, 1988, and I don't have it.
Oh, shit. Well, this has been an absolute joy. My God, we are two peas in a pod.
I like it. Sorry about the last time.
I know.
Listen,
I'm exactly the same. Okay, here are the stupid questions at the end I ask everyone.
All right.
What's your favorite film?
One of them.
one that you keep going back to, maybe.
Can it be a documentary?
It can be a documentary, yeah.
It may be a little over. Processed at this point because of the prevalence of like RuPaul's Drag Race or whatever, but Paris is Burning is...
I don't know. Tell me about it.
It's a documentary about the voguing and ball scene, houses in New York in like the late 80s. And I saw it. I went to the premiere on Michigan Avenue with my best friend, Honey Redmond, who is now Honey Dijon. In like 1991, we went and saw it and like cried, laughed. I've never been touched by anything in a theater or maybe in any kind of watching like I was then. I mean, I guess it was because I was very young still too. And I don't even think I had turned 20 yet. I turned 21 yet. But that is such a, and it's like a capsule. It's like a
time capsule, right?
Where it just, you know, New York, 1987, you know, New York, 1988, you know, and it gives you all these people's lives and stories. And
I'm going to watch that shit.
It really, really, really got me. It's soundtrack is great because it's like New York kind of house and disco and proto things, and then like some old Fourth and Broadway records and this sort of thing. New York in the 80s, whatever. That's my still reigning top pick. I even have a laser disc of it.
Oh, laser discs! I love laser discs. I sold my Laserdisc player to a Hong Kong technology museum, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, they came to my house. It's unbelievable. Anyway, what's your favorite TV show?
My favorite TV show?
It could be an old one, new one, box set, anything you want.
The TV I watch tends to be for ambience. Like I really watch TV.
I can dig that.
TV. So I end up watching just like something to have on in the background. Because I live by myself and I had, you know, a bunch of dogs. They don't give me ideas. They don't, you know, spark conversation. They just want either food or belly rubs. So the TV I watch is often like, again, sort of documentary kind of things. I watch a lot of like, paranormal caught on camera.
Oh, there you go.
And like, you know, these
you
sorts
need to
of
talk
like,
to our backing singers from Hair and 17. They're just that shit. We did a tour of America and they just, anytime we went into, they just wanted to go to the place which had the most ghosts.
The local haunted house.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that. I really like that. I had an experience once that was just utterly, really freaky. And so I'm not necessarily a card-carrying espouse aerator, whatever. I just I think well, maybe explain it. I don't know. I can't. Interesting. I'm gonna go walk the dogs up. You know, whatever. It's something that I can.
Well, tell us about the experience.
Click in and click out. Check out. I think I do like weird shows too, though. You know, things like I really like this Sandman show that Netflix did one season of it. It's got renewed for a second season, which I really liked. I guess all the shows I also like have like that kind of been. Constantine was a favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I like that when that was a show. There's another show called Grimm.
Oh, yeah. Really like the freaky stuff, right?
I like just weird thing. Like, wow, how did he turn into a ghost? How did he turn into a ghost? He's 8 feet tall. You're not going to kick it back. You know, like I like just odd stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you like reading or not. By the sound of it, maybe not. You read. What's your favorite book?
My favorite book was given to me by my friend Simi, and it's a Langston Hughes kind of collection of travel anecdotes, poems, and such. It's called "I Wonder as I Wander."
Oh, that sounds good.
By Langston Hughes, and I've read that probably 10 times. You know, I don't find much time to read anymore. I just, you know, like even when I'm on a plane, like I want to sleep. Who's that?
What's what?
What's that in the corner? Is that a cat? You got
it. Oh yeah, it's my cat. Hold on a second.
I just saw an ear poke in.
Here's Vito.
Hello.
Hello, Vito. He was asleep.
Yeah, I like that, and then also, another thing that I get into these like I don't know if they're like reference books or
I'm a nonfiction kind of guy personally.
Biology, yeah, I don't read much in the way of fiction just because it's hard to suspend my disbelief for me. Like the suspension of disbelief that is required to watch a lot of or to read, I don't know if I have the imagination to go places. I'm way too pragmatic. Like my dad's kind of like an engineer, so like, you know,
right.
It either is or isn't. You know, my mom's like teaching math and scientists. It either is or isn't.
So you're a science kind of guy then.
I would figure out a way to solve that problem.
Right.
Why didn't he just do that? You know,
he needs to come and work with me in my studio.
Yeah, I would have fixed his love life.
I need that pages. Shit.
You know, that kind of thing. Like 3 pages later, that should have been done.
Yeah.
But so okay. I think like that. But I read a lot of like art books, particularly on interesting artists. And then like these, I the Buffalo book by I can't think of his last name, but it's a book about like Buffalo, as in like Buffalo stance, as in like Nina Cherry, as in like the UK fashion and movement thing, mm-hmm. as opposed to like actual bison.
Okay. Did you ever meet Nina Cherry?
I did.
She's a nice woman.
Like a long time ago.
Yeah, she's an old friend of mine. So,
She's cool.
Part of the Notting Hill crew.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. What about? Is there a kind of? A kind of epiphanal moment. This is very professorial. Is there like a kind of moment of realization, a light bulb moment in your life, which changed you, or
Yes, I don't have many. I really don't. Like I always, I'm saying, more evolution than revolution. But when I was, I'd always liked music. I always, you know, was really into music. It was my escape. I was at one of our family reunions and the guy, Good Time Charlie, who we'd had DJ, a few of them, like I have a huge family. My mom had five sisters, wow. Six girls, My dad had 9 brothers and sisters. Wow. Each one of them were like, you know, my grandparents were ones of like 13 and 15 kids. Wow. And all sorts of things. Huge,
are you
huge
Catholic family. By any chance?
Huh?
Are you Catholic?
No, we're Southern Baptists. This is sharecropper shit. You have kids that work the land, Mississippi style. Because my parents are from like the deep South.
All right. But
we had a family reunion in, I believe it was New York at the time, and maybe Lansing. The DJ got a little tipsy. And, you know, I'd been admiring what he was doing because I'd never seen a mixer before. Right. You know, I was 8 going on 9. It was like the month before my 9th birthday. And I was like, what is that? What is that? What is that? And at a point, he like let me play. He's like, you wanna play a few? Like he was tired. Wow. Had like, you know, had a few drinks or whatever.
So how old were you? Is that fun?
8. Like I was going on 9.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, this is great. My mom's like, you know, worried that I'm gonna break something. Like she's worried about the cost. My mom's also very pragmatic. She's like, oh, don't do it, because you're not like, I got it. Played like a Tina Marie song, I believe it was.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Everyone went crazy. Like, I was like, power. I've never had such power as a fucking 8-year-old. This is, I can make adults do what I want to do.
And you remember which Tina Marie song it was?
I gotta say, it was, I believe it was I Need Your Lovin'.
Oh, God, yeah.
So I remember playing that. And then the other one also was DJing, where at that time, you know, we weren't mixing. You were just, you know, play a record, okay. Play another record. The first time I ever completed like a good mix was at my friend Ricky's birthday party. I was 11.
Wow.
And I did a mix, and that really like, what? I did it. It was
wow.
Circus, disco circus into visual, or visual. The music got me out of Martin Circus, disco circus. And I just felt like on top of the world. 7th grade, couldn't tell me a damn thing.
Yeah.
And those are those are the only two that really come to mind. Everything else is kind of like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, haven't hit me like, you know, like that ever
it's
did.
Such
like,
an amazing thing for a musician or a DJ at his peak to have that kind of, to be in the middle of that flow. It's something that non-musicians can't really understand, I think. When everything just pulls together. I mean, obviously, with a band, it's like when everybody's on that same wavelength and everything just pulls together and it just sounds amazing.
Yeah, see, I've only ever been in bands in, like, primary and grammar school. So we never really got it together like that.
As a DJ, you know, the skill that you, you know,
I like that when like you are on one and the crowd is locked in and everything is happening. That's amazing for me still. Like I still have these without being or sounding like a conceited ass, like if I'm doing something like and I feel untouchable. Like I'll just say, you can woo.
Yeah, absolutely. I can do that. Okay. If you hadn't been a DJ, what do you think in an alternate universe, what would your career have been?
I wanted to be a singer.
Well, can you sing?
I can.
And why don't you do it?
I could. Years and years of cigarettes and, you know, misbehaving and late nights.
You stopped on weights.
I've lost some of my prowess, but I did vocal instruction for 13 years. I thought I was, you know, I'm gonna sing these songs. Originally, you know, after a while, I thought I'm gonna sing these songs that I'm gonna produce and put out on my own label that I'm gonna sell.
Why don't you do it?
Vertical integration was my shit. I was just gonna do it all. But I always wanted to be a singer. Huh?
Do it now.
I do not have the energy to make a 10 o'clock fucking Zoom call. I'm not gonna do all that. I barely got here on time to do this. I'm trying to download Zoom. They're like, you need to update. I'm like, shit. I'm trying to figure all that out. I'm like,
no, oh, okay. Come on, you could do it. Anyway, when you got your Grammy in your hand, you know, I want a credit on that stage, okay?
For sure.
Okay. And finally, what's your favorite synthesizer and drum machine?
My favorite.
So many.
I think my favorite synthesizer is probably the Sequential 6-track.
Oh,
right. It's a tie between Sequential 6-track and JP8000. Because those were the things that I had independent of anything else. And so I really had to dive into them and use them and learn them and get to know them intimately. Yeah. Like, those are my, like, get into it. Sequential 6-track, because it also had, like, a little sequencer. And, yeah, you know, it was great for, I could do, like, weird wispy sounds, and then also gave me good basses, and you know, I really like that. The JP8000, I burned that thing. I just used to run it into the ground for like a whole, almost an album's worth of stuff.
Yeah, I had one of those too, and used it a lot. Yeah.
I loved it. Drum machine wise, for the longest time, it was the MPC 3000, which though isn't technically a drum machine. In the sense of like it has drum sounds built in, like I'm activating, you know, EEPROMs or anything like that. I love that because of the sequencing, because of the timing, because the shuffle was so awesome. I would carry it with me. I'd like go to England for the weekend, bring my MPC. They'd stop me coming out of customs, like, what's that? I'm like, it's an MPC 3000. Like, I make beats. I thought I was, you know, this was my jam. That thing carried me through my time in Barnet back before Sunday trading, when, like, you didn't have any stores open on Sunday, and I couldn't do anything. Only thing open on Sunday was, like, the combination BP Tesco Express at the top of the road. You could get gas and maybe some chips, and that's it. And the other thing,
Sunday was Beats Day.
Oh my goodness! It was like, yeah, why is nothing open on Sunday in England? And this is like even, you know, before satellite and cable. So it would just be like racing, car racing, horses, some soccer, and like a movie from the 50s. And then, like, you know, they shoot horses, not there, or something like that. They just got Channel 5, and everybody's like, ooh, we got four channels. that was amazing. So it would definitely be my MPC 3000. A close second, though, would be the TR-8S for a similar reason. Because
which brand is that?
It's a Roland. It's a new... they did a TR-8, and then they did a TR-8S, which, you know, I could you can put sounds in it on a little SD card and a fair amount of things, and it's got some capabilities. But now I just like I outsource all my drums to. I just got bunches of these like old like drum brains, like
Howard Drums-ish.
Like I got Thomas here. There's a couple Simmons over here. Drumfire, all these things, and I run them all with an Arturia BeatStep that programs all this stuff, and then I just whip this around when I need to do drums, and then push it back, and that's
Arturia will be very thrilled. I mean, they sponsor me, and
tell them, hey, I own three of these BeatStep Pros because I have to manage like the ones for like the Simmons and the Thomas. One's for this rack of Tamas and drum fires. And then I've got an old, which is the thing I'm fighting about now mostly, is a Clavia DD Rum 2.
Right.
And then some other old things that just like take triggers. So, like, you know, this little thing.
Oh, I love all these. Yeah, all these. Yeah,
just like all this little stuff, like boo, boo, boo. Like,
I met the guy. I interviewed the guy who designed the original Simmons.
Really?
Yeah. I can't remember his name now, but and somebody's going to tell me off on the listeners' panel.
Bob Simmons.
Could be. No, but who helped design all that stuff and came out with it? Disco would not be disco without that shit.
Would not. Not without those toms.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I went a little crazy with I didn't get any of the big ones with the cards. I just got a SDS 8, 9, a 400, and 800.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like ones that I could put on another one of these Jasper racks and just have easy to plug into. And patch to the patch bay and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Fantastic.
I love that stuff now more so than anything. And I'm growing. I just got this Percons that is really growing on me. This Erica Sense Percons thing that is fun and weird and strange modulations and things you can do with it that are sorcery, witchcraft. How did you do that? Yeah. I like that. I like that stuff too.
So finally, very finally, what's coming next?
Okay, so
have we got an album?
I'm entertaining this concept album.
Oh.
Ooh, jazz.
Hello.
The idea though is that there are no outside sound sources. Everything that happens on this album is in this room. Is made in this room. There's no samples. I'm not doing, remote recording, anything. If it's on this record, it happens inside of this room. Right. The microphones over there, all the drums, keys, everything, processing, all of it is done literally in-house in my main control room. I do have a small live room that's just on the other side of this wall, which is, if I need to, do something else. It's still, in-house. But to just do something in here that is just this, no loops that are brought in from anywhere else, nothing. Just if it happens, it happens here. I'm working on that as a project. I just finished a remix for Defected for this Breach song called Let's Jack. Got another remix that I'm doing for it. It's got Sean J. Wright. Used to work with Hercules and Love Affair.
I love that. Yeah.
Okay, so I have all the weird stories. That's my ex-boyfriend, and I bought him his first computer and got him to make music. And so
really
shout out to me.
You're taking some credit for this then.
I got all the I am a one man.
You're a maelstrom of creativity.
No, I'm not taking credit, but I did help get a start. But
listen, you are what they call it in the old days. They used to call it an animateur, right? People who animate, Diaghilev was for the ballet and stuff like that. It's like putting people together and making things happen and coming up with creative interconnections is the boom. That's what it is.
Mad dot connecting is what I used to call it, the MDC. I'm the mad dot connector. I'll put this with this and ping. Fixed it. Old school telephone. Frankfurt 700.
Well, this has been an absolute joy, I have to tell you. Thank you so much. I'm always blowing smoke at people's ass, but this really has been an unexpectedly great episode.
Thank you
so much, man. It'll be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And I will look forward. I hope I get to meet you someday when you come over to London again.
I'll give a shout. I know I'll be there in March because we're doing a album release for this club Space. It used to be at Bar Rumba on Shaftesbury Avenue.
I live 10 minutes from there.
I'm a Covent Garden boy. So I always stay on St. Martin's Lane. That's where my...
Oh, brilliant. I used to live around there. Yeah. I live in Marylebone now, which is just up the road. So.
Okay. Right on. Yeah. Well, you know...
Well, look, give me a shout when you come to London. I'll come down and say hello.
Right on. Excellent.
All right, man.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And have a great day.
You too.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye.
Derek, what a dude. Very impressed with his... It's really interesting digging under the surface of these people, because the most illuminating thing for me was when I asked him who his favourite artists were, and he said he didn't really think about things in terms of artists. He thinks in terms of styles and music, I suppose, is what he was saying. Or his kind of peers and contemporaries in the dance world. And I found that really quite surprising, because I maybe it's just, you know, me growing up idolizing various artists and thinking, you know, not that I want to be like them, but at least they provide a template. But his template was, you know, dance and beat mixing and blending a cappellas together with beats and. You know, he's a sparky character. It's very, very interesting episode, I think. How is everyone? Bloody cold in London. Even colder in Chicago. But the nights are getting... the days are getting a little bit longer. It's 1/4 hour every week, isn't it, roughly? So there is hope for us all. Please feel free to email me on electronicallymartin@gmail.com. And please consider subscribing to my Patreon site, which is patreon.com/electronicallyhours. It'll help me keep this advert-free, independent, and profane. I'd really appreciate it if you consider it. It'll help keep me enthused that I'm not losing money doing it, at least, and keep me paying for people like my lovely assistant Lucy and Chaz to help me keep this on the rails. So we have got some great guests coming up. I know you're going to enjoy it, so keep tuned. Bye. Got some questions when we did the Glenn & Martin special at Christmas. I just found a secret stash of them. So I'm going to ask them to myself. First question is, given the thousands of times you've performed live, it must have gone a bit wrong from time to time. What was the worst that has happened? I nearly smashed my shoulder to bits walking on stage and tripping over a monitor at the Roundhouse. That was pretty horrific. We've had various occasions where the music has been cut off because of a curfew and the PA switched off. And I talk about this actually in some of the podcasts, but that's pretty disastrous. We did a cruise, which is appalling. Hated every second of it. 30-meter waves. Our backing singers having to virtually run off stage to throw up during the middle of it with an audience that was completely disinterested. They just wanted to get in out of the cold and rain. Second question. These are all from Phil. M0KPH, who we converse from time to time. You also have many splendidly eccentric jackets. Do you get them from a specific store or just spot them in different shops? I used to get all my stage gear made by my tailor, Chris Kerr, who's in Water Street in Soho. He's really good. He does a lot of people in showbiz. And I've got a very beautiful blue, midnight blue sequin one, which I wear on stage, which cost about $1,000. And then I noticed online that there were much cheaper ones that could be done. But I still kind of go back to Chris to make the proper stuff that does proper touring. I might actually raffle off some of the cheaper sequin jackets that I've worn, or give them to charity or something. I don't know.